guided all of our campaign work. The campaigns we spent time on were campaigns that we spent time on because they checked multiple of those markers. It became a way of assessing official climate plans to judge them as whether or not they were just incremental or transformative. And it's also part of the legacy we're hoping to leave behind now that we've closed our doors. We spent a lot of time the last few months doing a special podcast series, working with Sticks and Stones in Edmonton to produce this great new 12-minute video, just leaving a whole bunch of resources on that six marker framework as a resource for our allies in the climate movement going forward to both critique where government goes and to lay out what a genuine emergency plan actually looks like.
I love the piece you have there about trying to force government to do it themselves, because like the scale is just so fundamentally different. I'm going to go to a music break. We'll come back and start talking about some of the things. But even the 40 million that you won, which may not have been the 1 billion that you were seeking, is still just such an astronomical number if you imagine like any nonprofit budget that exists in this entire country. So like if you imagine it being given to a nonprofit, it's not 40 million, it's 4 or 2 or 400,000. And like it, the scale does just absolutely change if it's actually being taken on by government.
That was a highlight from a recent episode of Green Majority. Find new episodes every week at greenmajority.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On this new interview, the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network's Ayman Shirwani unpacks how anti-feminist ideology shapes who does and doesn't get safe, adequate, and affordable housing. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Lorraine Chisholm speaks with Ayman Shirwani about how anti-feminist narratives impact women's housing and homelessness.
At a time when Canada is grappling with a deep housing affordability crisis, women and women-led families continue to experience some of the most severe housing need. The Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network is a national collective focused on research and advocacy to drive policy change that eliminates systemic gendered homelessness. In December, they submitted a brief to the Standing Committee on the Status of Women, calling attention to an issue that too often is missing in housing policy conversations. And that's the role anti-feminist ideology plays in shaping who gets safe, adequate, and affordable housing, and who does not. Ayman Shirwani is a research assistant at the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network, and she joins me now. Hello, Ayman.
Hi, Lorraine. Good to meet you.
Yeah, really good to talk to you. In November, a review panel appointed by the Federal Housing Advocate released its final report on the right to safe, adequate, affordable housing for women, two-spirit, trans, and gender-diverse women. What did they find was the biggest barrier to securing good housing? In November, a review panel appointed by the Federal Housing Advocate released its final report on the right to safe, adequate, and affordable housing for women, two-spirit, trans, and gender-diverse people. What did they find was the biggest barrier to securing good housing?
So the NAHA review panel came across with six main conclusions when it came to the gender-based realities that women and gender-diverse people go through when it comes to housing and homelessness, or even just housing precarity, with people of all ages and backgrounds that go through something like this. And that it's a crisis all throughout the country at the moment, particularly for Indigenous women, two-spirit, transgender, and gender-diverse people, that has an underlying tone of colonialism that is embedded all throughout. Similarly, Canada's national housing strategy hasn't fulfilled the requirement to improve housing outcomes for women, two-spirit, transgender, and gender diverse people, especially at a time of their greatest need, as they had committed to doing so in the housing strategy. And then lastly, it's that we often find that when you look at trends when it comes to poverty, when it comes to looking at equality. It's that housing is a factor that underlies all throughout at the intersection of gendered barriers that prevent women and gender diverse people from accessing safe accommodations.
Now, you say housing design and affordability frameworks in Canada have traditionally catered to a nuclear family model. How does that shape housing access?
Housing design and affordability frameworks in Canada, as you know, have traditionally catered to a nuclear family model where the male partner or the husband, as a primary wage earner, has financially provided, and then the wife or the female partner has taken on unpaid domestic responsibilities, childcare, and part-time employment at times. And the result has created a dynamic where when the cost of living rises, that nuclear family model is no longer realistic, even when there is a two-parent household. So when you put single mothers into the equation, they have the odds stacked up against them, because not only is the current housing crisis unrealistic for a two-parent household, it's borderline impossible for single mothers that are living alone with the rising cost of living overall.
Now, how are women-led families, especially those fleeing abuse, harmed by the lack of affordable and safe family-sized housing?
Well, it's very nuanced. I think the main demographic that is impacted by the lack of family-sized housing are single mothers with children. It's very often the case that alongside housing, there are a lot of other factors at play that impact the affordability of housing overall, namely it's childcare. It's also being able to have a job that pays enough to pay for that childcare on top of pay for a quality of life that is deemed acceptable by child services for children to be able to have, alongside just housing that child services deems acceptable. A lot of women have their children taken away from them, and then as a result have their housing taken away from them because their living accommodations are deemed unacceptable. But unfortunately, it's a broader systemic issue of, well, the landlord is not making timely repairs on apartment buildings, or this, that, and the other when it comes to these systemic factors all coming into play with each other.
And so when women are in situations like that, if they're fleeing abuse and then their accommodations become unstable, does that increase the risk of returning to an abuser?
It does, actually, especially if the whole reason they had been living independently to begin with was because they had fled abuse. It's not always the case that a single mother living alone with kids is fleeing from violence, but when it is the case, when that housing does become unaffordable, it's either they have to turn to an emergency shelter, but moving back with an abuser is often one of their last options and their last resorts, but many women find themselves having to do so.
Now, Amy, let's talk about women who are so often marginalized. Are Indigenous and 2SLGBTQ plus at greater risk of homelessness or inadequate housing?
That is what was determined by the NAHUB review panel, alongside a lot of the data that the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network has collected throughout the years, such as the Pan-Canadian Housing and Homelessness Survey that we conducted a couple of years prior, alongside our State of Homelessness Literature Review. We basically found that they are disproportionately affected by the housing crisis, not only because there is a colonial undertone here that we are talking about that has intergenerationally reinforced cycles of poverty, cycles of homelessness, and cycles of violence, but also with the gendered element of things, we find that homelessness is a factor that is experienced younger and younger when it comes to Indigenous women and gender diverse people. So much so that we have found that it's girls young as 13 who are reporting that that was the first time that they had experienced homelessness. And from then on out, it was a cycle that continued up until adulthood.
Now, you point to the rise of anti-feminist rhetoric, and before we talk about how it affects housing, let's take a step back. Talk about the manosphere. What is it and what is it promoting?
The manosphere. I feel like it crept up on us, really. But I would most likely define it, and the way that I defined it in our brief was that it is a system of media networks and ecosystems across not only entertainment, books, literature, television shows, even podcasters like on YouTube. And it's the promotion of a rhetoric that calls for a return to traditional gender norms. So it's not overtly anti-feminist on the surface, because it's so often that it is content tailored towards men that says, oh, how to become a real man, or how to attract women, how to do your best at the gym, or how to, quote unquote, be an alpha. But covertly within these messages, there is an underlying tone of anti-feminist rhetoric with the reinforcement of gender roles, especially in content that has women as the subject matter. There's very often the case that they use very reductive and harmful lenses to refer to single women, and more importantly, single mothers, particularly when they are talking about women to avoid, when they are talking about who's a good candidate for a relationship.
And how do these views intersect with and influence access to housing?
Well, that is a very loaded question. There's a couple aspects that are really pertinent. Mainly, I would say that there's a narrative of moral failure here. It's very often the case that single mothers are portrayed as women who, quote unquote, made bad choices and must now, you know, quote unquote, live with the consequences of their actions. And what are those bad choices here? It's from a structural level, it's that they are grappling with wage inequality, housing costs, and childcare that ultimately lead them into systemic situations that they're in, where now they are dealing with housing issues and housing precarity. And these types of rhetorics, they position gender-based hardship as a personal fault rather than a systemic failure. And then at the same time, I would say that the manosphere, it frequently argues that social supports such as like childcare subsidies, income supports, they say that they reward bad behavior, that bad behavior being something that is often completely out of control. And it reframes basic survival supports as indulgences, quote unquote. And that, I guess, legitimizes cutting them off or restricting them from the support that they need.
So you give some examples in your brief of discrimination faced by single mothers fleeing abuse. Can you draw that out a little bit for us and how these narratives might play into that?
So there is an undertone of economic liability framing. It's very often the case that single mothers are described as financial burdens by the manosphere, and to men, to the state, to society. And many of these public figures warn other men from pursuing relationships with single mothers for this reason. And I can honestly point to a very popular one, Andrew Tate, not to name names, but he is a very high visibility example of how anti-feminist ideology is repackaged for media consumption, especially among young men. And some of these young men, when they get a little older and they have the opportunity to become landlords, let's say they inherit a house or they end up purchasing a property, they are going to hold on to those viewpoints and create the risk of projecting them onto women tenants as well as their children. And at the end of the day, when you view women tenants with children as burdens rather than people, you end up seeing them as like high risk, unreliable, too expensive. And it creates a cycle of, or a form of systemic discrimination that excludes women and children from the housing market if they don't have a man on their shoulder to protect them from these realities.
Now, Eamon, why is this important right now? Why are you pushing the Standing Committee on the Status of Women to acknowledge that anti-feminist ideology is not merely cultural rhetoric, which it is, but also a material barrier to women's housing security?
Well, I think we can all agree right now the housing crisis all across Canada has reached an absolute tipping point. And we, through our brief, we're wanting to call on the government of Canada to develop a gender-based analysis plus framework to build more nuanced gendered supports for Build Canada Homes. And it's Canada's new federal housing program. we would want it to be not only rooted in gender-based knowledge, but also Indigenous knowledge and principles that are more tailored to housing development. And that would be in collaboration with community partners and people with lived experience of housing security. And at the end of the day, we want it to inform all federal housing investments and decision-making to ensure that housing is not just a tailor-fit affordability framework for a nuclear family, but that we are now creating affordable family-size housing for single mothers with the understanding that many of the people who are in need and are the most vulnerable people wanting to access affordable housing cannot do so because of the lack of gender-based responsiveness in this affordability framework.
And I think you're talking about making a minimum allocation for women, two-spirit, trans, and gender diverse people.
That's right. So we are calling for allocating at least 40% of affordable and deeply affordable housing units for women, two-spirit, trans, and gender diverse people. And we are wanting not only to target Build Canada Homes, but also the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Association. And essentially just at the end of the day, ensuring that the housing budget does not rely on a one-size-fits-all approach, because we know that housing is not neutral at the end of the day. It's always been with an undertone of gender and with an undertone of that for housing to work, especially for a nuclear family model and for a traditionally gender-based society, it relies on the backs of unpaid labor from women.
Well, it's really been good to talk to you today. And these are some ideas and some issues that I really haven't heard about. So I really appreciate your bringing them to the fore.
Thank you so much, Lorraine. I also call on all of your listeners to check out our website. I think there's a lot of good stuff there when it comes to emerging data on housing and homelessness. If anyone wants to get a better understanding of what gendered homelessness is and the nuances that shape the gendered reality specifically for women as they navigate all of these systems all at once.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lorraine.
I've been speaking with Ayman Sherwani. Ayman is a research assistant at the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network, and you can find them online at womenshomelessness.ca.
You've been listening to the Red Eye Podcast, produced by an independent media collective based in Vancouver. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be great if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people to find us. Also, please consider sharing this episode with a friend or telling someone about our podcast. To keep up with the show, you can subscribe to Red Eye wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can follow us on Blue Sky at Red Eye Radio. I'm Jane Williams. Thanks for listening.
There's a new interview from Red Eye. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. And finally, broadcasting since 2014, Vancouver-based Seriously Wrong is a utopian leftist comedy podcast featuring co-hosts Aaron and Sean and guests in conversations exploring rent strikes, the justice system, airplane food, and more. Look at a highlight from this episode where desperate times call for desperate measures as all hope for the future rests on what Papa and Boy decide to do next. On this excerpt from part 7 of the spectacular saga Genocide, Apocalypse, The Injured Boy Inside. Now, here's Seriously Wrong.
Papa, can you read me a story before bed?
Boy, well, let's see. Did you finish all your chores?
Yes, Papa.
And did you finish your homework?
Yes, Papa.
Have you been polite and considerate today?
I have, sir.
And let me see. Do you get a story?
Could you tell me the ending of the story, The Legend of Papa Fatherson and Boy Fatherson? Finish it finally? Can we get to the end?
Oh, you want to finish the Papa and Boy story? You want the finale, the very end of it, the whole rest of the story?
Oh, please, Papa. And I've been a very good boy.
Do you remember where we left off? This is very important if you're going to hear the end of a story. Or do you need to start over at the beginning again?
Oh, no, yes, Papa, I remember exactly where we left off. Papa Fatherson faked Boy Fatherson's death to turn him into a political martyr to advance his own agenda against Boy's will after Boy escaped to boycott territory when he was made into a public figure for his great capacity to do surgery when he had no capacity to do surgery. And he took on a new identity there, Hilarious Boy, became one of the leaders of boycott and developed a new system for training papas to be more boyish called the Boy Father System. And unbeknownst to him, his first student and test case is actually his own father, Papa Fatherson, who was captured by Boy Cult but had his mustache shaved off, so Boy Fatherson couldn't recognize him. And of course, Boy Fatherson was wearing face paint, the war face paint of all the boys, so Papa Fatherson couldn't recognize him. At the same time, the Fatherson Protectorate faked Papa Fatherson's death to turn him into a political martyr to advance their agenda against his will, and power has now been centralized in the hands of Father Dearest, the hard-fisted ruler who turned the Fatherson's ever-escalating war on the boys against the very people who was promised to advantage, the fathers. Like a patriarchal boomerang that threatens to destroy everything that both papas and boys hold dear.
Very good, boy, but you forgot one part. Do you remember what became of Little Mulligan?
Oh, that's right, Papa. He was sold out by Boy Cult, who he believed to be his allies, and captured by the Fatherson system and brought to the Great Boy Punishment Complex. But he was freed in the Great Boy Punishment Complex jailbreak, and his adopted father, struggling father, is still mourning his dead original son, struggling boy, so much that it's taken over his life in a way that doesn't seem healthy. It's not really clear how Mulligan feels about it, but it is clear that his stepfather is neglecting him emotionally, and his current whereabouts and affiliations are unknown.
That's my boy. What a memory on this kid. You know what, son? You're ready. You're ready to hear the end.
Thank you, Papa.
The finale of the Papa last... and Boy.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let me just open up this tome here. The movie every father is talking about.
A tasteful depiction of the real-world issue of Papa Shrimp slaves held hostage in Boy Cult territory. Father Rights Watch.
A triumph of the father's spirit, a refutation of boyhood. Deadspot.
Prestigious Papa is earning his 5 Pipey Awards in every frame. Papa Cool Reviews.
A depiction of a Papa slave escape and boy massacre that will change cinema. 5 toolboxes out of 5. Pop's Popcorn Flicks.
A movie that understands what it's like to be a modern dad. No BS, no hand-holding. Jed Popper Pop.
Not a dry mustache in the house. Top Papa Entertainment.
Every hour is worth it. Buckle up, Dad's Net.
If only Papa Fatherson was alive to see this. The Honorable Daddy Dadson.
700,000 loyal 5-star reviews for Freedom for Fathers. A deeply moving slavery epic. Now nominated for 12 Pipeys and 8 Golden Grills, including Best True Story. A movie to bring awareness to Boy Cult war crimes. A movie that reminds us what it means to be a father.
Now playing.
We now go to a Boy Cult training dojo where a radical procedure to tame and reform fathers using the experimental Sunfather system is underway.
No. Pick up the ball and throw it again. You call that a limp, boyish throw? You can do worse than that. Again, limper. Drop to the ground, give me 50, and say, Papas don't know best.
Papas don't know best. Papas don't know best. Papas don't know best. Papas don't know best. Papas don't know best. I don't want to cry, but I am.
You call that anyways. Crying? Why are you holding back?
Papas don't know best.
Sob harder. Now march right over to that toy box and pick the toy that is the most fun.
When I open the toy box, I will know organically what seems fun. I'll just pick it without thinking. Puzzles and superhero action figure.
You don't look like you're having fun to me.
I'll figure out which toy to play with.
Oh, you can't play with me as another toy.
Are you playing or are you pretending to play?
I'm not a toy. I'm a real superhero. I'm going to use my laser fart to explode God.
Now you're getting it. Let loose.
Now that God isn't real, I'm going to play this xylophone, which is giant to me.
I think
think he's starting to get it.
I didn't think it was possible.
All right, you may approach me. Present your homework.
Can I play with toys right now instead?
Very good. You've passed the final test. Your coloring has been consistently outside the lines. Your bed not been made in months.
Thank you.
I can't remember the last time I checked up after bedtime when you were actually asleep.
Got a little flashlight under the covers, reading magazines, comics, or looking at pictures.
The kernel of fatherhood grows from the injured boy inside. The only way to truly let go of the father within, the father that's still bossing you around.
I quiet the voice of the eternal father, but I still feel his presence.
In order to become a boy again, a real boy, we need to remove that kernel, heal the boy inside.
I'm ready, master. Sorry, apprentice.
We're going to journey back to when you were actually a boy. Close your eyes. Think about the first spinny cap you had as a boy. Look at the propellers spinning and spinning.
Oh, wow.
Now, think about the first time your papa made you feel like what you want doesn't matter.
No, papa. I want to stay on the car when you drive. I'll sit on top of the car. No.
Sink back into the injustice. Feel
don't
it
pick me up.
Inside
I,
your
don't
gut.
Don't pick me up. I don't care what it is, papa. I want to eat it.
Now move forward. Think about a time you did that to your boy.
You have to be a surgeon like your grandfather, okay? Stand-up comedy is not a good career for a boy.
Stand-up comedy?
You're a test case, boy.
Test case for what?
No, you have to do the surgeries, every single one of them, on those babies, or else I'm a failure. You wouldn't want your father to be a failure.
This is a highlight from a new episode of Seriously Wrong. Find the internationally acclaimed utopian leftist comedy show at seriouslywrong.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's independent journalism aggregation website featuring more than 30 progressive publishers. You get all your news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 86 socially and politically progressive podcasts. Go to harbingermedianetwork.com to subscribe. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
On CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Gulls are notorious for snatching French fries from waste bins and flocking to landfills. But one Western gull's devotion to trash reached a new level with an epic road trip. Since 2013, researchers have been tracking Western gulls nesting on islands off San Francisco. Their GPS data show that, on average, foraging gulls will travel about 11 miles away from their colonies. Then, in May 2018, a female gull took a trip like no other. She started by flying inland to a Bay Area transfer station. It's a waste facility where food scraps are loaded onto semis and hauled to a compost center in the Central Valley. But the tracking data show that after leaving the transfer station, the gull followed the highway east for 80 miles to that Central Valley composting facility. The only explanation? She was riding a transfer truck. The gull may have gotten trapped in the truck unintentionally, but it delivered her to 216 acres of glorious garbage. And shortly after returning to her colony, she repeated her trek. It's the first time scientists have documented such an unusual commute. But as human activity continues to alter Western gulls' natural habitat, maybe this new approach to dining out will catch on. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.